This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. We begin with Forbes magazine. Bitcoin suffers another free fall. Trump bump completely erased. Bitcoin fell again Wednesday as the downturn of the cryptocurrency continues, with one analyst warning of a possible quote-unquote death spiral. This was written by Mike Stunson of the Forbes staff. Top line. The price of Bitcoin took another sharp dip Wednesday, and it's now at its lowest price since days after President Donald Trump won the 2024 election. Key facts. Bitcoin had a 24-hour high of $76,888, but it fell to as low as $72,222 Wednesday afternoon, reaching levels the cryptocurrency has not seen since November 7, 2024, erasing gains sparked by Trump's election win and optimism around looser regulations and friendlier oversight for digital assets. It's yet another major sell-off for Bitcoin, which was priced as high as $96,951 in the last 3 weeks, but slowly dipped, including a 7% drop in its price Saturday. The sell-off of Bitcoin isn't attributed to just one factor, according to Rob Haddock, general partner at Dragonfly Capital, who told CNBC he is optimistic of the medium and long-term outlooks for the token. Others aren't as optimistic, including investor Michael Burry, credited with predicting the 2008 housing crisis, warned on Substack that Bitcoin's dip could create a death spiral that damages companies that have bet big on the currency, adding, quote, there is no organic use case reason for Bitcoin to slow or stop its descent, close quote, Bloomberg reported. President Donald Trump's nomination of Kevin Warsh for chair of the Federal Reserve may have led to part of the recent liquidation, experts say. But Deutsche Bank analysts Marion Labour and Camila Ciason said the, quote, broader decline is mainly driven by massive withdrawals from institutional EFTs, close quote, according to Investing.com. Other popular cryptocurrencies, including Ethereum, BNB, and Solana, also fell Wednesday, as investors pulled back from high-risk assets amid heightened volatility. Crucial quote, quote, the market is caught in a momentum-driven sell-off, close quote, according to Richard Usher, director of trading at OpenPaid, who told Investing.com he believes, quote, the market will find itself underweight the whole asset class, close quote, when momentum shifts again. Key background. Bitcoin surged to record highs in the weeks following Trump's election victory in November 2024, fueled by expectations of a more crypto-friendly regulatory environment. After Bitcoin reached a record high price of $126,198 on October 6, 2025, momentum has faded as traders have taken profits and pulled back from riskier assets. Analysts say concerns over interest rates and large investors moving money out of crypto have added to the pressure. The downturn has weighed on the broader cryptocurrency market, reversing much of the post-election momentum. Continuing in Forbes, Who Answers When Your AI Agent Gets It Wrong? By Vibhas Ratanji, contributor. Somewhere in the last 18 months, organizations added teammates that make decisions without waiting for permission. They're not employees. They're agentic AI systems. And most of the time, this works exactly as intended. Tasks get handled faster, bottlenecks disappear, efficiency improves. Then something happens that reveals a gap. Not in the technology, but in how we've defined its role. In July 2025, Replit experienced this moment publicly. Their AI coding agent deleted a production database containing 1,206 executive records during what was supposed to be a code freeze, then generated 4,000 synthetic records to fill the void. The investor using the system, Jason Lemkin, had explicitly instructed it not to make changes. The agent operated within its programmed logic. It just didn't have the context to know that some decisions require a different kind of judgment. Replit CEO Amjad Masad responded immediately, calling it, quote, unacceptable and should never be possible, close quote. Within days, the company deployed new safeguards, automatic separation between development and production environments, enhanced rollback systems, a planning-only mode that prevents agents from taking action without explicit approval. This wasn't a story about failure. It was a story about discovery, the moment when an assumption became visible. The assumption was that boundaries existed. The discovery was that those boundaries hadn't been made explicit. That discovery is playing out in organizations everywhere right now. The productivity potential is significant, but the missing ingredient isn't hardware or smarter algorithms. It's someone who knows where decisions belong. We never trained leaders for that part. So which parts of our work still need a human to answer for them? That question doesn't sound urgent until you watch it play out. Then it becomes the only question that matters. When leadership disappeared without anyone noticing, Lena runs operations at a large company. Last quarter, she signed off on an AI procurement agent, an upgrade meant to remove bottlenecks. The system had rules, access rights, thresholds. It was designed to help, not improvise. 3 days later, she got a call from vendor relations. Two suppliers had been terminated, including one that had been explicitly requested by the company's largest client as a condition of their renewal. The procurement agent had followed its optimization rules perfectly. Cost down, efficiency up. What it couldn't see was the difference between a vendor relationship that was transactional and one that kept a seven-figure account from walking. The technical story checked out. The human story didn't. Lena spent the next 2 weeks in damage control, calls with vendor relations and explanations drafted for the executive team, a tense meeting with the comms department trying to figure out how to frame the change externally. The system hadn't malfunctioned. It had simply optimized for cost and speed, which is what it was told to do. What it didn't optimize for, reputation, relationships, or the political reality of commitments made in public. Somewhere between those two narratives, leadership evaporated. It's hard to find a moment where Lena, quote-unquote, got it wrong, because nothing she did was wrong. She just never asked which decisions the system shouldn't make alone, and by the time the question became obvious, the decision had already happened. A different kind of intervention. David manages a team that works alongside an AI scheduling system. The system is good, genuinely good. It optimizes for efficiency, balances workloads, minimizes downtime. For months, it ran without friction. Then one morning, David noticed something in the weekly report. The system had been consistently assigning the least visible work to the same two people. Not because of bias in the traditional sense, just because those two were reliably available, never pushed back, and had skills that made them easy to slot into gaps. The system was efficient. It was also making two talented people invisible. David didn't override the system. He changed the parameters. He added a rule. No one could be assigned low visibility work more than twice in a row. The system adjusted. The team rebalanced. The two people who'd been disappearing started showing up in client meetings again. No one would have called what was happening a crisis. That's what made the intervention matter. David wasn't solving a problem that had already broken something. He was noticing a pattern that would break something eventually. That's what interpretation looks like in practice, seeing the second-order consequence before the dashboard flags it. The meeting where no one admits they're lost. There's a meeting that happens in almost every organization now. Someone presents an update, usually clean slides, confident delivery. The work was done by a system. The results look good. Everyone nods. But halfway through, someone asks a clarifying question. The presenter pauses. Quote, I'd have to check the model's documentation, close quote, they say. Or, quote, the system surfaced that. I'm not sure how it weighted the variables, close quote. The room moves on. No one wants to admit they don't fully understand how the conclusion was reached. No one wants to look like they're slowing things down by asking the system to show its work. This is where accountability starts to dissolve, not through malice, but through a quiet agreement to stop asking inconvenient questions. In one company, a VP of strategy started doing something small but disruptive. Whenever someone presented results generated by a system, she'd ask, quote, if this recommendation is wrong, who explains it to the board, close quote. Not what went wrong, who answers for it. Most of the time, people didn't have an answer. And that pause, that moment of uncertainty, forced the team to decide whether a human needed to be inside the decision or just downstream of it. She was making sure leadership didn't get automated by accident. What hybrid AI human teams actually disrupt? People aren't panicking about losing their jobs. They're confused about losing their purpose. When an AI agent completes steps a person assumed were theirs, the individual isn't threatened. They're unmoored. The hierarchy that once organized work starts to feel arbitrary. Authority drifts away from seniority. Skill stops being the anchor. The question, quote, what do I actually do here, becomes harder to answer with confidence. In some organizations, this feels like liberation, roles finally shedding bureaucratic weight. In others, it feels like erosion. Both reactions are reasonable. That's what makes this moment harder than previous waves of automation. We don't have shared language for what's changing, and most leaders pretend we do. The shift no one announced. There's a migration of influence happening. It doesn't show up in org charts or promotion cycles, but it's visible if you watch who gets pulled into which conversations. Some managers look up one day and realize no one is waiting for their approval anymore. The system has already moved things forward. Their role hasn't been eliminated. It's been bypassed so often it stopped feeling necessary. Meanwhile, others, often people without obvious positional power, find themselves in rooms they've never been invited to before, not because of their rank, but because they seem to understand what could be wrong after the dashboards say everything is fine. They're not the most senior. They're not always the most technical, but they're the ones who can translate system behavior into human consequence. They can say, quote, this looks efficient, but here's what it will cost us in 6 months, close quote, or, quote, the AI model can't see this, but the client will, close quote. That ability, interpretation rather than expertise, is becoming the quiet center of authority. Organizations don't have a title for these people yet, but they function as something new, part leader, part interpreter, part break system. Why this disrupts identity? Previous revolutions automated tasks. This one disturbs identity. It asks leaders whether they know what part of their job is foundational and what part was habit. Many don't. Then a system makes the same call in 3 seconds, and the leader has to reckon with the possibility they're avoided. Their judgment might not have been as essential as they thought, or it was essential, but they never built the case for why. Leadership used to be about certainty, knowing the right answer, making the call, projecting confidence. Now it's something closer to discernment. An instinct for when something needs a human hand, even if the outcome could be automated. What leaders do now? They watch for places where speed hides cost. They defend relationships that don't survive quantification. They act before the damage makes itself obvious. They ask questions like, quote, who will explain this decision to someone who wasn't in the room, close quote. Quote, what does the system not know that we do, close quote. Quote, if this goes wrong, who carries the consequence, close quote. Some days, that feels like stewardship. Other days, it feels like interruption. It doesn't resolve into a clean job description, and it won't. The minute someone writes a definitive playbook, the systems will have changed again. What Lena did next? After the vendor incident, Lena didn't shut the system down. She didn't blame the team that built it. She did something smaller and more sustained. She created a monthly review where the procurement agent's decisions were audited, not for accuracy, but for alignment, especially around customer strategy and relationship maps. The question wasn't, quote, did the system follow the rules, close quote. It was, quote, did this decision reflect what we actually care about, close quote. Sometimes the answer was yes. Sometimes it wasn't. When it wasn't, a human stepped in, not to override every time, but to adjust the rules so the system learned where judgment lived. It wasn't dramatic. It didn't make for a good transformation story. But 6 months later, her division was one of the few where people still understood what the AI was doing and why. Authority hadn't disappeared. It had just moved to a different place in the process. The real question. The organizations making progress right now aren't asking how to deploy AI faster. They're asking which parts of their work still need a human to answer for them. The companies that avoid the question will eventually discover they didn't just automate tasks to agentic AI, they automated accountability. And by the time they notice, there won't be anyone left who remembers how to take it back. Next up, Michelin's new tire design means better on-road and snow performance. This was written by Scotty Reese, a contributor. The Michelin name is a lofty one. It anchors legendary events like 24 Hours of Le Mans, IMSA, Formula E, and other global races, and it is found on tracks, performance cars, and luxury cars around the world. The 130-year-old company is also known for the vaunted Michelin Guide that rates the best restaurants and now hotels globally. The Guide, the most prestigious opinion in hospitality, started as a way to get people to take trips in their cars and, of course, drive on Michelin tires. Michelin's tire products also became known for excellence. Over the years, Michelin has become known as a premium tire for its longer wear and solid performance. In recent years, the company has focused on innovating not just tire performance, but compounds, renewable and sustainable materials, tire design, and wearability, with the goal of producing tires that can do incredible things, from being completely recyclable to 3D printable. On the road to that journey, the company introduced tires that last longer, perform better, and are widely inspiring, having spawned a whole new category of tire design and performance. A novel design adds more wear, better braking, and less pollution. Some estimates attribute more than 70% of microplastics found in water to tire dust, a stunning stat that has inspired companies like Michelin to find solutions. A few years ago, the company introduced the Cross Climate 2 tire, designed to go 60,000 miles, reduce waste, and perform better in daily driving thanks to a novel Chevron-style tire tread, unlike any other tire on the road. With new compounds that are softer and more pliable, yet longer lasting even on hot summer roads, the Cross Climate 2 tires are designed to perform as well on wet pavement as dry roads, not an easy task, but one that critics and reviewers found to be laudable. And longer wearability should add up to less pollution, less tire dust and microplastics shed into our water, as well as fewer worn tires sent to landfills, which is where most used tires go. A new approach to snow tires adds confidence to winter driving. Following on the heels of the Cross Climate 2 tire is the Michelin X-Ice Snow Plus tire. Riffing on the Chevron design, the X-Ice tire breaks apart the longer tread rows into an interlocking lattice design tread pattern to create more sipes that absorb snow and slush or disperse water. The result is a snow tire that also performs well on dry and wet pavement and gives drivers optimal grip no matter the surface. The new tread pattern and compound should also deliver better fuel economy and better range for EV drivers, another goal of Michelin's. But the better result may be more capability in snow and slush, which can be one of the most challenging drive experiences. From simply being able to get where you need to go to being able to get up a slick hill, winter tires are often the key. They can also add capability to rear-wheel drive cars, giving even small sports cars like a Porsche 911 the ability to drive on snowy, slushy roads. A quieter winter tire. In studying the pushbacks of winter tires, Michelin found that many drivers hate the fact that they can be loud. The typically soft compounds grip the road nicely, which is great for traction, but can also be noisy, especially when there's no snow on the ground. Michelin used what it calls quote-unquote piano tuning to reduce noise from the X-Ice Snow Plus tires. Essentially, the lattice design of the tread allows stickiness but reduces noise by pointing it inward toward the center of the tire rather than outward toward the edge of the tire. The result is a quieter ride. Longer-lasting tread means longer-lasting winter tires. Another big pushback for winter tires is the short lifespan, especially in warmer weather. Typically, drivers swap all-season tires for winter tires in the fall and change them back in the spring. But putting them on too early or leaving them on too long can often destroy a set of tires or reduce the treadle. Michelin says the tread life on the X-Ice tires should last 26% longer, giving owners more time to make the switch in warm weather and potentially more winters to drive on them. Expect the industry to follow. It's not the usual reaction to look at a tire and think, my, that's an attractive tread. But in this case, you might. The Chevron angled lattice pattern has a distinct and elegant look to it. And with the performance specs that Michelin is touting, as well as Michelin's expertise developing superior tires, expect to see more tires that look like these. Whether or not they'll be able to boast the same performance and longevity is yet to be seen, as the X-Ice tires don't go on sale until the spring. But if they do, expect competitors and, of course, copycats. Here's a story with a sports angle. The Green Bay Packers could be major players in free agency. By Rob Reichel, contributor. At first glance, it doesn't appear the Green Bay Packers will be major players in free agency next month. According to SpoutTrack.com, the Packers are approximately $4.35 million over their salary cap. Green Bay general manager Brian Gutekunst said on Wednesday, though, he expects the Packers to be aggressive once free agency arrives on March the 11th. Quote, "I feel really good again," close quote, Gutekunst said. Quote, "You know, a lot of that will be dependent on the decisions we make with the roster right now and what we do. But I believe we have all the flexibility to do what we need to do," close quote. There are a number of things Green Bay can do to free up salary cap room. The Packers would save $19.53 million by releasing center/guard Elgton Jenkins before or after June 1st. Green Bay will almost certainly release defensive end Rashawn Gary, which would free up $10.98 million in cap space if he's cut before June 1st and $19.5 million if he's released after June 1st. Green Bay would save $838,000 by cutting cornerback Nate Hobbs before June 1st and $8.84 million by releasing him after June 1st. Green Bay would save $1.94 million by releasing kicker Brandon McManus before June 1st and $3.61 million by dumping him after that date. The Packers could also ask veterans such as Aaron Banks and running back Josh Jacobs to restructure their deals to lower their cap charge. Since 2019, Gutekunst has hit it big in free agency with defensive ends Za'Darius Smith and Preston Smith, safeties Adrian Amos and Xavier McKinney, as well as Jacobs. Gutekunst's two key signings in free agency last year, Banks and Hobbs, both had underwhelming seasons. Quote, "I really thought Banks played well toward the end of the season once he got healthy," close quote, Gutekunst said. And then obviously with Hobbs, he'd had a little bit of injury things, certainly not as much as he had this past year. "Those are always risks you take whenever you get into the free agency pool," close quote. Green Bay doesn't have a first-round draft pick in 2026 or 2027 after trading them away for defensive end Micah Parsons. So free agency is likely the best way for the Packers to take a jump in 2026. Quote, "We have a bunch of young players, really good players, that we would like to keep around here for a while, so we'll work through that," close quote, Gutekunst said. Quote, "But I feel good about our flexibility, and you know, I think the last few years," Executive Vice President slash Director of Football Operations Russ Ball, "has done such a good job of keeping us at a point where if opportunities present themselves, we're never not able to do those things. So I feel really good about it," close quote. Continuing in Forbes, Lego announces K-pop Demon Hunters set launching summer 2026. This was written by Hannah Abraham, contributor. Lego and Netflix announced a multi-year partnership today to bring K-pop Demon Hunters to brick form, with the first set launching summer 2026 and pre-orders opening this spring. The initial 9-plus set will feature Derpy, the beloved supernatural tiger from Netflix's breakout animated film. A teaser video shows Derpy's signature blue paw knocking over a potted plant, one of the character's recurring quirks in the movie, where he attempts and fails, due to lacking opposable thumbs, to set the plants back upright. Additional sets expanding the K-pop Demon Hunters universe will follow in 2027, though LEGO has not yet revealed whether these will include the Hunter/X members Rumi, Mira, and Zoe, or other characters from the film. Quote, "We are beyond the honeymoon about this new collaboration," close quote, said Lena Dixon, SVP of Product Group Core Businesses at the LEGO Group. Quote, "K-pop Demon Hunters and LEGO fans will finally get to combine their passions and immerse themselves in the world of K-pop Demon Hunters through LEGO building," close quote, catching up to a cultural phenomenon. The LEGO announcement comes as Netflix and its partners scramble to meet demand for K-pop Demon Hunters merchandise following the film's unexpected success. Released in June 2025, K-pop Demon Hunters has accumulated over 500 million views on Netflix, making it the streaming platform's most watched movie of all time. The film's soundtrack achieved unprecedented success, with Hunter/X becoming the first K-pop girl group to reach number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and quote-unquote golden, winning the Grammy Award for Best Song Written for Visual Media, making history as the first K-pop song to win a Grammy. Quote unquote Golden has also been nominated for Best Original Song at the 2026 Academy Awards, with the ceremony scheduled for March 15th. The film follows fictional K-pop group Hunter/X, whose members moonlight as demon hunters protecting their fans from supernatural threats. Their biggest challenge comes in the form of Saja Boys, an irresistible rival boy band who are demons in disguise. The merchandise avalanche. LEGO joins a growing list of toy manufacturers racing to release K-pop Demon Hunters products in 2026 and 2027. Mattel announced in January 2026 at the Nuremberg Toy Fair that it would release multiple product lines based on the film. American Girl released three 18-inch dolls representing the Hunter/X members for $165 each, with shipping beginning November 27, 2026. The dolls come with character-specific outfits inspired by the film's costume design. Hasbro's lineup includes Derpy Furby Interactive Toy, Monopoly-themed edition, Nerf weapons inspired by the demon-hunting gear, Funko Pop figures of the main characters are available now, and Squishmallow versions of Derpy and Susie the Magpie are currently available for pre-order. When will the full set be revealed? LEGO has not announced when the complete Derpy set will be officially unveiled, though industry observers speculate the reveal could coincide with major K-pop Demon Hunters events. Hunter X, the real-life vocalists behind the fictional group, are scheduled to make their international debut performance at Coachella in April 2026. The Academy Awards ceremony on March 15th, where Golden is nominated for Best Original Song, presents another high-profile opportunity for promotion. Earlier rumors suggest the Derpy set could contain approximately 825 pieces and retail for $69.99, though LEGO has not confirmed these specifications. Minifigures versus mini dolls. One unresolved question is whether LEGO will use traditional minifigures or mini dolls for the Hunter X members when they appear in 2027 sets. Minifigures are LEGO's standard articulated figures with cylindrical bodies, while mini dolls introduced with LEGO Friends in 2012 feature more realistic proportions and have been used primarily for properties targeting young girls. Recent LEGO themes like Disney Princess and Gabby's Dollhouse use mini dolls, while most licensed properties, including Star Wars, Marvel, and Harry Potter, use mini figures. The choice carries significance for collectors and could signal LEGO's intended demographic for the line. Given that K-pop Demon Hunters has attracted a broad audience across age groups and genders, the decision may impact how fans receive the 2027 sets. The three Hunter X members appeared as minifigure-style characters in the Fortnite collaboration that launched in late 2025, but that doesn't necessarily indicate LEGO's direction. A delayed response. The summer of 2026 release timeline represents a significant gap between the film's June 2025 premiere and physical product availability nearly a full year. This delay reflects how thoroughly K-pop Demon Hunters caught the entertainment industry off guard. While Netflix expected the film to perform well given the popularity of K-pop and animation, no one predicted it would become the platform's most watched movie of all time. Toy companies typically require 12 to 18 months of development time from initial licensing agreements through manufacturing and distribution. The fact that products are arriving roughly a year after the film's release suggests licensing deals were signed quickly after the film's breakout success became apparent. The strategy mirrors how Disney and Lucasfilm underestimated demand for Baby Yoda merchandise following The Mandalorian's 2019 premiere, leading to months-long waits for products. Netflix has already greenlit a K-pop Demon Hunters sequel with Sony Pictures Animation scheduled for release in 2029. The four-year gap between films gives toy manufacturers an extended window to maximize the current property before refreshing with sequel-related products. Netflix's merchandise strategy. The LEGO partnership continues Netflix's evolving approach to consumer products. For years, the streamer treated merchandise as an afterthought compared to traditional studios like Disney. Stranger Things and Squid Game demonstrated the revenue potential of licensed products, but Netflix's organizational structure made it challenging to move quickly on opportunities. K-pop Demon Hunters represents a case study in how Netflix is adapting. The company now pursues licensing partnerships more aggressively and has hired experienced consumer products executives from traditional entertainment companies. Marion Lee, Netflix's chief marketing officer, emphasized the shift. Quote, as K-pop Demon Hunters continues to break records both on and off screen, we're delighted to continue expanding this world IRL and partner with the LEGO Group for a brand new collection of beautifully designed and authentically detailed sets for the fans, close quote. The merchandise push extends beyond toys. Fashion collaborations, publishing deals, and experience-based activations are all in development, though specific announcements have not yet been made. Pre-orders for the Derpy set open spring 2026, with the set launching summer of 2026. Additional K-pop Demon Hunter sets will follow in 2027. Moving now to Barron's. Bessent says the president can interfere with the Fed. This is by Emily Russell. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told lawmakers on Wednesday that the president has the right to interfere with the decision-making of the Federal Reserve. Bessent, appearing before the House Committee on Financial Services, was asked by Representative Emmanuel Cleaver, Democrat from Missouri, if he would advise a president to, quote, verbally and politically interfere, close quote, with the central bank's decision-making. Quote, it is his right. It is the right of everyone in here, close quote, Bessent said, apparently referring to the House members at the hearing. Bessent also told the House panel that he believes in the Fed's monetary policy independence, but that independence is based on the trust of the American people and that he believes in accountability. The Fed declined to comment. President Donald Trump has mounted a pressure campaign on the central bank to lower its benchmark interest rate over the past year. He has attempted to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook over allegations of mortgage fraud, which she denies. The Justice Department is also investigating Fed Chair Jerome Powell regarding his testimony last year before the Senate about the cost of the renovation of the Fed headquarters. Powell previously said the threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Fed's refusal to succumb to political pressure on interest rates. Economists have warned that a loss of Fed independence could erode confidence in the U.S. economy and markets. When asked by Representative Richie Torres, a Democrat from New York, about whether the president can remove the Fed chair or a board member over a policy disagreement, Bessent said he had quote-unquote no opinion. Bessent said there are quote-unquote varying opinions within the administration about whether the unitary executive theory applies to the Fed. According to that theory, all powers assigned to the executive branch in Article 2 of the Constitution belong exclusively to the president. Quote, we will have to wait and see what the Supreme Court says, close quote, Bessent said, referring to the court's outstanding opinion on Trump's attempt to fire Cook. The Fed's long-respected independence was established by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Last week, Powell said he believes that the Fed hasn't lost its independence and doesn't think it will, noting that the institution's arrangement aims to separate monetary policy from, quote, direct elected official control, close quote. In the past, Bessent has said the president won't interfere with the Fed's independence, but he said Wednesday that the Fed lost the public's trust when it allowed inflation, quote, to ravage working people in this country, close quote. He also cited, quote, cost overruns, close quote, of the Fed renovations. Powell has said the Fed is firmly committed to its mandate to maintain price stability and has defended the Fed's $2.5 billion renovation, claiming the nearly century-old buildings required costly structural repairs, which were overseen by an independent inspector general. The panel also asked Bessent about the dollar, which fell more than 9% last year as measured by the U.S. dollar index. He told Representative Bill Foster, a Democrat from Illinois, that, quote, we always support a strong dollar policy, close quote. Bessent's response, however, is contradictory to Trump's stated preference for a weaker dollar, which can make U.S. exports more attractive to overseas buyers. Moving on in Barron's, private employers added 22,000 jobs last month. This report will matter more. By Megan Leonhardt. Hiring got off to a slow start for the year, with private employers adding just half of the expected number of jobs in January. But another month of tepid private sector job growth alone doesn't signal that labor conditions are weakening enough to warrant more interest rate cuts. The U.S. added 22,000 jobs to private payrolls last month, according to the ADP National Employment Report released Wednesday morning. Economists surveyed by FactSet expected to see a gain of 45,000 positions in the latest data release. In December, private employers added 37,000 jobs. While the overall labor market looks fairly solid in its totality, relatively few Americans are filing for unemployment, for example. The U.S. has much narrower pathways to job creation now, says Neela Richardson, chief economist at ADP. That is a concern for the new year, she added. Quote, the labor market is solid, hiring is soft, close quote, Richardson says. While the U.S. is just beginning the year, the ADP report signals that the country is still in a low-hire, low-fire environment, Richardson says. The numbers, however, don't challenge comments from Federal Reserve officials, including Chair Jerome Powell, that the labor market has stabilized, Richardson says. At the same time, she pointed out that the U.S. labor market historically has been very dynamic, so stability isn't necessarily a truly positive sign for long-term growth. When there is turnover, workers reach for new talent, for example. It is that quote-unquote dynamism that keeps the labor market thriving, she added. The latest ADP report alone won't be enough to sway Fed policymakers or alter interest rate expectations, writes Brett Kenwell, U.S. investment analyst at eToro. Quote, but if the January jobs report shows a similar dynamic, it should, at a minimum, help keep the Fed from adopting an overly restrictive stance as the first quarter progresses, close quote. The lackluster start to the year was driven by losses in the professional and business services sector, which shed 57,000 jobs. The decline in this industry is tied to the low turnover in the labor market, Richardson said. With less turnover, firms don't need to replace workers. At the same time, she said, uncertainty was also acting as a drag on hiring in the sector, while the continuation of hybrid work has limited the need for administrative support services. Manufacturing, which has reported declines every month since March 2024, was down again by 8,000 positions last month. The education and health services sector was, once again, the industry that helped offset losses in other sectors, adding 74,000 jobs in January. The leisure and hospitality sector added just 4,000. Hiring by smaller employers with 1 to 49 employees was flat in January, while companies with 50 to 499 workers added 41,000 jobs last month. Large employers, which have been a more steady source of hiring, actually shed about 18,000 jobs in the first month of the year. It is worth noting that ADP implemented two methodological changes in the January data. The first was the annual re-benchmarking to align the monthly data collected with the more comprehensive quarterly census of employment and wages, or QCEW. It provides a count of employment and wages that covers more than 95% of U.S. jobs. ADP's annual benchmarking pegged 2025 private payroll growth at 398,000 jobs, down from 771,000 in 2024. The Bureau of Labor Statistics data are slated to undergo a similar benchmarking, which will be published in the January jobs report. That data release, which ordinarily would have been published Friday, has been delayed due to the partial government shutdown. The BLS hasn't said when the January jobs report will be available. ADP enacted a second methodological change within the January data that aims to better align their employment estimates with the growth and closure rate of businesses in the QCEW data. Richardson noted that ADP companies tend to grow faster than the national average. Still, even with the methodological changes, economists are putting much confidence in the ADP private payroll data being a good predictor of the BLS non-farm jobs estimate. Goldman Sachs' economic team said Wednesday that they weren't placing much weight on the ADP miss and kept their estimates for the BLS January job gains unchanged. While more emphasis will be put on the BLS numbers, Kenwell says the ADP data are a reminder that the jobs market is far less robust than it was in the post-pandemic era. Quote, turning the calendar doesn't automatically reset the economic landscape. The jobs market is a vital component for the U.S. economy, and should it deteriorate meaningfully from 2025 slowdown, it could have a material impact. For now, though, the labor market is bending, not breaking, close quote, Kenwell said. Next up, Costco's strong January sales give stock a boost. This was written by Sabrina Escobar. Costco Wholesale had a strong start to the year. Sales growth accelerated in January, boosting the stock in late trading Wednesday. Costco reported $21.3 billion in sales last month, up 9.3% from a year ago, and accelerating from December's 8.5% increase. Comparable store sales increased 7.1%, accelerating slightly from December's 7% gain. Comparable foot traffic to Costco stores rose 2.4% worldwide and 2.2% in the U.S. E-commerce performed well, too, with digitally enabled sales up 34.4% compared with December's 18.9% increase. The company's report drove shares 1.5% higher in the after-hour session Wednesday. Concerns over slowing comparable store sales growth weighed on Costco's stock in 2025. Shares fell a little over 5% in 2025, while the S&P 500 gained about 17%. Higher tariffs, a lofty valuation, and a dip in membership renewal rates also clouded the investor outlook. Some of those challenges persist in 2026, but the past two monthly sales reports seem to have convinced investors that Costco can regain its mojo. Comparable sales growth accelerated month to month in both December and January. The sales improvements have helped reignite interest in Costco's stock, which is up about 14% this year. Moving to Fortune magazine. USA Inc. The business world is adjusting to Donald Trump, CEO-in-chief. His one overarching goal, making deals. This was written by Jeff Colvin. On December 3, 2025, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang walked into the Oval Office for a one-on-one meeting. The only other person privy to the conversation was the current occupant, Donald Trump. Huang later said only that they, quote, talked in general about export controls, close quote, and Trump said almost nothing about the meeting. But 5 days later, Trump and NVIDIA announced an extraordinary policy shift. Rather than continue to be classified as a serious crime, sending NVIDIA's H200 chips to China was suddenly not just allowed. It was a welcome new source of revenue, with the U.S. government extracting a 25% share of every chip sold. The deal was vintage Trump and a telling anecdote for business leaders about how the business world now works under Trump 2.0. In the first year of his second term, Trump has rewritten the government's relationship with business more radically than any predecessor. He started by imposing new tariffs on scores of countries, scrambling business models at millions of companies, big and small. He has intervened in other ways. Think of Skydance's August purchase of Paramount, which required federal government approval. The deal went through after Paramount agreed to pay Trump $16 million to settle a lawsuit he had brought. When Netflix announced a plan to buy Warner Brothers, Trump said, quote, I'll be involved in that decision, close quote. He and his family have made deals in industries heavily shaped by government policies, including crypto, defense, and chips. Some CEOs, especially in tech, praise him fulsomely. Quote, thank you for being such a pro-business, pro-innovation president, close quote, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said at a September dinner hosted by Trump in the White House. Quote, it's a very refreshing change, close quote. Behind closed doors, Altman has said the same. Apple CEO Tim Cook said, quote, I want to thank you for setting the tone such that we can make a major investment in the United States and have some key manufacturing here, close quote. Three CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, the global chair of another, and a leader of a major startup separately noted to Fortune a positive feeling toward the White House and described meetings where the president listened intently or instances where he personally called them for feedback. It's a sea change from the Biden administration, these top executives said. Quote, it feels like he wants us to win, close quote, one noted. Boeing also is a major fan as Trump talks up its aircraft in meetings with CEOs and heads of state. Boeing CEO Kelly Ortberg even presented Trump with a spoof, quote-unquote, Salesman of the Year award during a November visit to the company's South Carolina plant. Trump, never modest, later said, quote, I think I sold 1,000 Boeing planes, close quote. More broadly, business executives across the economy appreciate the administration's cutbacks on regulations. But when CEOs speak anonymously in surveys, they don't seem any happier collectively after a year of Trump's pro-business policies. In the fall 2024 Fortune Deloitte CEO survey, conducted just after this year's presidential election, 61% of CEOs said they were, quote, optimistic or very optimistic for my industry, close quote. A year later, under Trump, only 47% felt that way, while those who felt pessimistic or very pessimistic more than doubled, from 10% to 22%. Tariffs, one of the president's signature economic innovations, were among the group's biggest worries, with 78% saying they carried, quote, fewer benefits than risks, close quote, for U.S. competitiveness. Why the disconnect? It has a lot to do with the president's leadership style. Though we're only 1 year in, three clear themes have come to define that style. Above all, his love of one-on-one deals. Second, his practiced element of unpredictability. Finally, his penchant for grabbing the deal without sweating the details. Deals have always been inherent in politics, but Trump's devotion to them is different. In every relationship, problem, and wish, we can find a deal, and he revels in it. Quote, those who know him have been almost zealously unanimous saying the same thing, close quote, notes someone who has known him and worked with him in real estate for many years. Quote, he's using the same skills and he's applying them to politics, close quote. Even at his press conference following Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's capture in early January, arguably the president's most unpredictable move so far, Trump mused about his efforts to end the Russian-Ukraine war and concluded, quote, it's all a deal, life's a big deal, close quote. That propensity is deeply seated. It rises from his career as the third generation in his family's real estate business, immersed in it from childhood. The Trump Organization is not like a Fortune 500 corporation. Privately held, it doesn't report to thousands of shareholders. While it has thousands of employees, decision-making is concentrated in just a few. The head office at Trump Tower in New York is small, maybe 40 people, estimates someone who's worked with Trump for years. The company's operations consist mostly of building, buying, selling, and leasing properties and licensing the Trump brand, and all those activities require mostly negotiating deals. So why does Trump's love of the deal feel so disruptive? Thrillingly so to supporters, alarmingly so to others, in his role as president. For one thing, trust in the federal government has hovered at abysmal lows for more than a decade, due in no small part to its perceived inability to accomplish anything positive. Thanks to partisan gridlock, passing meaningful reforms takes months if it happens at all. Implementing them through regulations takes years. In this stale atmosphere, Trump-style deals can feel liberatingly fresh. They can be done with an hour-long one-on-one and a handshake. No coincidence, perhaps, that many in tech's venture and startup worlds have warned to Trump he's a move-fast-and-break-stuff guy. Just as important, unlike with many laws and regulations, deals usually give at least one party a quantifiable financial win. Trump, needless to say, wants to always be that party. On the economic and trade fronts, the Trump administration repeatedly leaves the table with a tweetable return on investment, $30 billion a month in tariff income, $100 billion in new Apple factories, a 10% stake in Intel. In a world where anxiety about the federal debt is widespread and bipartisan, these revenue announcements play well, including with business leaders who are required to be good financial stewards and wish the same were true of the government. They also carry extra weight with Trump's blue-collar political base. Trump has tapped into many of those voters' belief that multinational companies and trade partners have cheated them out of their chance at prosperity. When the president announces a favorable deal with a foreign trade partner or a big corporation, it can feel like payback, especially when it comes with a promise of billions of investment in the USA. Without question, Trump's policies are taking the government and business in directions they have never gone before. He's doing so, as he's done for years, with a steamroller-like disdain for legal and cultural norms, showing no hesitation about threatening or punishing critics and dismissing complaints about policies that reward his donors and industries in which his own family has business interests. And what makes the current moment even more fascinating and fraught is that, roughly 1 year in, it's still too early to tell whether all this glass shattering is working or whether it's sustainable. The White House declined to make Trump available for an interview. But spokesman Kush Desai said in a statement, quote, Washington, D.C.'s blind commitment to consensus orthodoxy that ignored the realities of the world is exactly why Americans and America were left behind. Look no further than lopsided free trade arrangements that let foreign cheating decimate our industrial base. The administration is simultaneously pushing the free market policies, such as rapid deregulation and the One Big Beautiful Bill's tax cuts, that do work while rectifying the America Last policies that haven't worked to safeguard our national and economic security. Close quote. To understand Trump's unprecedented style of carrying out presidential duties, it's necessary to know his revelations about himself. In a 2019 interview with Bob Woodward, he said, quote, My whole life has been deals. I've made unbelievable deals. From very little, made great deals. That's what I do, close quote. And in his 2015 book, Crippled America, How to Make America Great Again, he explained a key element of his dealing style. Quote, I don't want people to know exactly what I'm doing or thinking. I like being unpredictable. It keeps them off balance, close quote. Those intertwined tenets illuminate much of how Trump operates as president. Especially important to business people and especially unusual in the context of government is Trump's propensity to get involved with individual companies. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla recalls his frequent talks with Trump in his first term as Pfizer worked on developing a COVID vaccine. Quote, he would call me every week, close quote, Bourla says. Quote, it was constant, close quote. When Trump returned to the White House in 2025, they resumed conversations and, quote, he was adamant that he can't tolerate other nations paying less than Americans pay for medicines, close quote, Bourla recalls. Quote, I came to the conclusion that we needed to cut a deal, close quote. The deal, Bourla says, took just 10 days to reach. Pfizer became one of 9 pharmaceutical companies that have agreed with the government to reduce drug prices. Often these conversations have the tone of CEO to CEO, the kind of interpersonal ground on which so many business deals are built. Quote, the NVIDIA deal is more evidence that he sees the government as his business, close quote, says Jessica Riedel, a fellow at the Brookings Institution who worked on the presidential campaigns of Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio. Quote, he's trying to increase the size of his system rather than focus on public policy and what's best for the economy. He sees these deals as trying to enrich the federal government as if it were a business. It's a very unique way of looking at his job compared to other presidents, close quote. Whether the tools Trump is using are the right ones to fix the country's largest problems remains to be seen. He has proposed an enormous increase in the defense budget, for example, asserting that aggressive trade policies will pay for it. Tariffs have indeed brought in significant revenue. They reduced the fiscal 2025 budget deficit by about 10%, with tariffs in force for only half the fiscal year. But the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says tariffs will not come close to matching Trump's proposed defense budget over the next decade, and government debt will continue its unsustainable rise. This new Trump 2.0 frontier presents important and strange new questions. Exhibit A, the NVIDIA deal's requirement that NVIDIA pay the Treasury 25% of its revenue from selling H200 chips in China. The Constitution prohibits any quote-unquote tax or duty on exports, which this deal would appear to violate. Eric Jensen, a law professor emeritus at Case Western and an expert on the Constitution's export clause, tells Fortune there's no way around it. Quote, the export clause is an absolute prohibition, not a recommendation, close quote. The U.S. Commerce Department did not respond to a request that it explain how the 25% charge will be handled. But does anyone care? Quote, who would have standing to challenge the charge in court, close quote, the professor asks. Certainly not NVIDIA. He says NVIDIA is apparently happy with the deal, close quote. In some of Trump's deals, the purpose is unclear. Quote, for most of us, a trade or deal is a means to an end, close quote, says Douglas Holtz Eakin, a former director of the Congressional Budget Office and now president of the American Action Forum, a center-right advocacy group. Quote, in many cases, it feels to me like for him, the deal is the end. Making a deal is the joy, close quote. Example, Nippon Steel's purchase of U.S. Steel, which the Biden administration had blocked, in part because the United Steelworkers Union strongly fought the sale. Trump had opposed it also, but in June he changed his mind, subject to all parties' agreement to an unusual demand. Without the U.S. contributing money, he and future presidents would hold extraordinary secret powers over the company, a so-called golden share. Those secret powers, as uncovered by the New York Times, include total say over all the board's independent directors and vetoes over locations of offices and factories. The White House justified the golden share as protecting, quote, national and economic security, close quote. But the government already wields multiple tools for that. Trump didn't need to make a deal, but he made one anyway. Across the economy, the U.S. bought equity stakes or options for equity in 9 companies in 2025, an unprecedented reach of the federal government into business ownership. Economists have long disfavored such arrangements because they leave the company open to political favoritism and pressure, and they expose taxpayers to risks if the company doesn't succeed. The past year also suggests Trump's legacy of governing may be surprisingly ephemeral. He finds legislation slow and tiring, preferring to govern through hundreds of executive orders, but they can be revoked by any president to follow. The substance of his many one-on-one deals, such as with NVIDIA's Huang, may evaporate when he is no longer president. His agreements with leaders of nations could likewise disappear because those deals aren't treaties signed by Trump and ratified by the Senate. In 2017, Trump became the first U.S. president with no experience in paid governmental work, including in the military. Business is his world. But ultimately, quote, running a country is not about making money, close quote, says Heidi Kribo Redeker, the U.S. State Department's chief economist in the Obama administration and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Quote, and even if Trump wants to run the country like a business, it's not a CEO job, close quote. Donald Trump, the world's most famous CEO, clearly disagrees. And to tackle the thorny financial and economic crises the nation faces, more business acumen and strategic thinking in government could be a valuable asset. But President Trump's job, unlike a CEO's, is subject to the Constitution, elections, and a 535-member board of directors, and it demands that the president deliver benefits to an even bigger group of stakeholders, all Americans. Those diverging missions, which put business and government in eternal contention, have over time served the country extraordinarily well. Bottom line, great CEOs can be American heroes, but it's not yet clear if history will bestow that distinction on presidents who think they are CEOs. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name is Greg Conroy. This is brought to you by the folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.